one of the goals that we want to reach, so that you know what comes ahead, is to demonstrate the following remarkable fact, that, and this is not true in arbitrary quantum field theories, that in conformal field theories, the correlation function of any number of local operators, so these are operators that live at a point. Remember that the field theories can have operators that are supported on other dimension and co-dimension surfaces, are completely determined or constructible from the two-point function, from two-point and three-point. So that means that the two-point is just OIX OJ0. So ING label the operator. And the three-point function will be something like I JK. So this is a huge simplification, because essentially any correlation function can be reduced to the knowledge of these correlation functions. Of course, this is still a hard problem, because this index I goes all the way to infinity in the necessarily in dimensions bigger or equal than 3. Actually, there's an anomaly. There's an exception. In the equals 2, it's possible to construct conformal field theories with a number of operators from which you can construct the whole theory. Truncate is an indefinite number. These are called rational CFTs, and you will see about them next week. Okay. So this is very remarkable, that the constraints of symmetry reduce the whole problem to computing the two and the three-point function. Which is still, of course, it's still a hard problem, but it's a drastic simplification. And this, as we will see, is that there are consequences of making use of symmetry from the beginning. Okay. This is, by the way, a useful thing to do always in physics. First, you do the kinematics. So this is the cookbook recipe for any problem in physics. First, you do the kinematics. You constrain. You write down the most general thing that's allowed by kinematics. That already is a huge simplification of the problem, because it organizes things in a way that is compatible with the symmetries that your problem has. And then once you have completely fixed the kinematics and nothing else, no other information can be obtained from kinematics alone, then you go to dynamics. Okay. But doing the first step as completely as possible simplifies physics tremendously, because then it makes many things manifest, and many formulas that would look obscure if you don't think of the symmetries that the problem has would look very opaque. Okay. So today we're going to start with, obviously, number one. Okay. So let's start with the kinematics of conformal field theory. And actually, if you wish, for this particular problem, even before we start talking about kinematics of the conformal field theory, we just have to talk about geometry. So the first step will be to understand in detail what are these conformal transformations. This is a concept that exists irrespectively of field theory. It's a question about geometry, and then we will understand how these questions about geometry are realized in field theory. Just like Poincaré transformations have nothing to do with field theory, you can study them independently of field theory, but then you can also ask how they're implemented in field theory. So we're going to study today the geometry of conformal transformations. Okay. Now I will not. I will present all the key steps that go into understanding what the conformal transformations are. There are certain steps that I will skip that are just purely arithmetical, and they're in the notes, and they're like just doing a little bit of, you know, Sudoku with mathematics. I mean, just high school mathematics, but I don't think it's, there's a point of me doing it in the Blackboard. It's just solving simple linear equations. But if there's any conceptual question, of course, you can ask me. Everything is in the note. I think you're getting notes, right, I believe? Yeah. Okay, so what are we talking about? So remember what I said is that conformal transformation is, conformal symmetry is a generalization of the notion of Poincaré symmetry. It's a generalization of a space-time symmetry. So these are going to be transformations. So this is supposed to be a cartoon of space-time. I guess for most of these lectures, okay, for all of these lectures, I guess, or most of it, I will be in flat space-time. This notion of conformal transformations can be also studied in curved space-time. And this has important applications in various problems, but for now, we'll be in Minkowski space. And I'll be cavalier about being in Lorentzian or Euclidean space. So you can be RD or R1, D minus 1. Nothing very essential will happen. You can analytically continue one into the other. So a conformal transformation is a space-time transformation that maps a given point x to a given point x tilde of x. Okay? So it's a coordinate transformation, x mu to x mu as a function of x. That it can be, and this can be set in different ways, that has the following properties: that one preserves angles between vectors. And I emphasize here the word angles as opposed to distances. So distances we don't care about. The transformations that we're looking at are blind to changes of distances. We are okay with that, and the reason in physics is clear, because these transformations will be applicable to theories that look the same at all length scales. So if your transformation changes things just by changing the distance between points, this will not affect the physics. Or to equivalently also, this transformation is the, okay, it would be the most general transformation that has this property, okay? We're gonna say the most general space-time transformation that has this property, or equivalently the most general transformation that preserves the light cones. You know, light cones are the things that define the causal structure of your space-time. So these are transformations that will preserve the causal structure of space-time, but will not preserve distances. So what is the kind of transformation that obeys this? The kind of transformation that obeys this is one that is isotropic, so that it sends the metric in this way. This obviously preserves light cones, because light cones have zero length element. So a zero length element is mapped to zero length element. And the distance is preserved because you compute the inner product of two vectors divided by the norm of the vector, and this overall factor just drops out. Is that clear? Okay. And this omega is an undetermined function for now that we're going to determine very soon. Okay, so this is, okay, so but now let's spell out this formula in a bit more concretely what this means. So we're looking for these transformations, x to x tilde, that have this property that, so let's just write this more explicitly. So that means that okay, this is equivalent. Let's write in something that we can work more easily. This is totally equivalent to saying that we want to solve this equation. We want to solve for the x tildes that obey this, that have this property.
Okay.
Now, if this was just one, this would be the transformations that preserve the Minkowski metric. So if omega was zero, this would be a transformation that preserve the metric. I don't know if you've seen this word. These things are called isometries. So transformations that preserve the form of the metric are called isometries. And the isometries of flat space are just the Poincaré transformations. OK. But now we're interested in a generalization of that. Now, a priori, you might think that this set will be infinite dimensional because I have put no restriction whatsoever on this function W. It could be anything. But we'll see that there are restrictions. Now, let's first try to get some kind of intuitive understanding of what is this transformation. So what I can do now is do the following. Let me just define the following matrix, R, rho, mu, which is dx tilde rho dx mu times e to the minus omega x. All I did is I took this guy to the other side and split it into the two Jacobians. If I write it this way, this is gives us some insight of what's going on, because now what condition does this x-dependent matrix obey? Can someone tell me what does the equation that R obey remind you of something that you've seen before? Sorry?
A 9-bind or PL-bind?
No, because these are curved in this. Well, curved is a bit of flat space. No, it's not that. I mean, what in plain language, what equation does R obey? Or in an unplain language, what equation does it obey? And where have you seen that equation before? I'll write it. I mean, you can write this as a matrix equation also, right? What is this as a matrix equation? It's something, OK, so let me write it. Is it clear that all I did is divide by e to the minus 2 omega and put one omega here, one omega here? It's a Lorentz transformation, yeah? But now it's x-dependent. You got Lorentz transformations. When you solve this equation, the Lorentz factor is constant, right? It's just a rotation, a constant rotation. So in written in this form, the equation in matrix form, it would be like this. Which is precisely a Lorentz transformation. The Lorentz transformation is the transformation that preserves the metric. Of course, in Lorentzian signature, it preserves the Lorentzian metric. So that means that this cookie transformation that we're looking for can be thought of as a local Lorentz transformation. Lorentz should be written properly. Local Lorentz transformation combined with dilatation. So this is good because I think we all have an intuition about Lorentz transformations, and we all have an intuition about dilatations. The thing that's weird now is that this is the Lorentz transformation and the dilatation that you apply can be different at different space-time points. Okay? But locally, you know what we're talking about. OK. So what we're going to do now is to focus on, for simplicity, also because these are the most important ones, the same thing with the Poincaré group. We're going to focus on the transformations that are connected to the identity. To the identity transformation. So these are, by definition, transformations that map any point to a nearby point. Okay? there are transformations in life that obey that equation that will map a point here to a very far away point. We're not going to worry about this for now. We're going to come back to them later. So by the way, the same thing happens with Poincaré transformations. There are the transformations that are close to the identity. These are they have a name. I don't know if you know the name, but there's a set of transformations. And there are transformations that are Lorentz transformations that, like parity, that maps a point very far away from it, right? So if you have a point that parity sends the point x equals 100 to x equals a minus 100, right? This is not a nearby point. So we are not going to capture these transformations by going close to the identity. In mathematical formulas, going too close to the identity just means that in this picture that I drew, we're going to send x mu to x mu tilde, and that's, we're going to linearize this. We're going to say that x mu tilde is x mu, so back to the same point, plus a little bit, zeta mu as a function of x. Okay? This is what it means to be close to the identity. It means that it's 1 plus something. And with you think of this something, it's small. It's very small. You can think of this zeta mu as a vector field. You know, transformations of space-time, in general relativity or whatever, are implemented by vector fields. So the vector field associated to this transformation is an abstract vector zeta that we use this notation. I don't know if you've seen this notation, but that's how transformations are implemented in general relativity. And you can think that this makes sense because if I act on this vector field on the coordinate x, I get precisely this, right? If I act this vector field on x mu, you get just x mu. OK, so now we just have to expand that thing. That's easy. Well, the first thing to say is that, first of all, before we do this, actually, this equation is not completely independent of everything else. What I can do is I can take the determinant of this equation. Okay, maybe it's, so I can take the determinant of this equation, right? And this tells you that the determinant of this matrix. So this notation means determinant. Okay, so this is the determinant of this matrix. It tells you that taking the determinant that this thing, dx tilde rho dx mu, so this guy will be square. So the determinant square equals omega, sorry, e to the 4 d omega, right? Because I just get d times this guy. It's a diagonal matrix. So the determinant of the diagonal matrix is the product of the eigenvalues. So you get this factor d times. Why did I put factor of 2 there? It should be factor of 2. OK? Good. So now let's go back to this linearization of the conformal transformation. We're just analyzing the conformal transformation. So all that we have to do now is take this and plug it into this, right? And compare the left-hand side and the right-hand side to zeroth order and to leading order in zeta, which is the small parameter, because we're doing a small transformation. So this is just some. So I'm going to write it once. But I mean, this is really elementary. So OK, so. That doesn't mean that I cannot screw it up, but it's elementary. So this is will be, so if I take dx tilde dx of this thing, okay, so let me remind you that we are now looking at x tilde mu equals x mu plus zeta mu. So that means that equation, the conformal, that equation has a name, it's called the conformal, well, don't worry about the name. So we have eta rho sigma is delta rho mu, I'm just taking derivatives, plus d mu zeta rho. That's the first term, right? And the second term is delta nu sigma plus delta nu
zeta sigma, right?
I haven't done anything. I'm just doing two. I'm working to linear order in zeta. Okay. So I'm not doing dot dot dot. Okay. And this equals. Okay. So now I have to linearize this transformation, and I leave it as an exercise. I think you that this thingy. Essentially is 1 plus, where am I going to screw up some factor? The divergence of the vector. And now is there a factor? Okay, so the way you do it, you use this formula that you may have seen before. So the determinant of a matrix M, so it is a matrix, right? This thingy here. The terminus of the matrix is exponential of the trace of the logarithm of the matrix. So I'm trying to compute the determinant of this guy to linear order. Okay, so this is the exponential of the trace of the log of 1. So it would be delta mu nu, right? So delta, essentially, I'm just plugging this in here, right? So delta rho mu plus d mu 0, right? Now, the log of 1 plus x is x, I believe. So, and now I take the trace. So that will give you exponential of again, I'm working to linear order in zeta. Okay. So is this a factor of 1?
It's probably 1 over d or something.
Well, the factor of, no, I think the factor of 1 over d comes once you solve for a little omega. But the Jacobian itself does not have a 1 over d, I believe.
Oh, the theory,
yeah. Yeah. So I'm just, I mean, I wrote an equation, right? The question is the equation correct? I think it's correct.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that means that I just now plug in. I use this equation, right? I plug this into this equation, okay? And that gives us indeed 1 plus 2 over d, because I have to divide, maybe not a factor of 2. 1 over d, let's see. Eta. Mu nu. Sorry, and I'm forgetting the. Okay, so now let's compare this to order by order. So let's look at the zeta to the zero term is trivial, right? It trivially matches. It just tells you that eta mu nu. Oh, there's an eta mu nu here also. That eta mu nu is eta mu nu, right? I just pick up the zeroth order term here. So we have that eta mu nu equals eta mu nu. So this is true. And then to order zeta, so maybe let me do it here so there's more room. So to order zeta, what you get is that d mu. So I just have to multiply out things, right? So I have d mu zeta nu plus d nu zeta mu equals there's a factor of 2 because I'm doing e to the 2 omega, right? So there should be a 2 here. Okay. So, and now I just pick up the linear term there, right? So it's 2 to the d eta mu nu. So this is the equation that whose all solutions parameterize all conformal transformations that are close to the identity. Now, again, if this was 0, then this would be like the killing vector equation of Minkowski space, whose solutions are the Poincaré transformations. Okay, but now we have something a little bit more. Because okay, so let me just say that if delta zeta equals zero, then we get Killing vectors. I call the Killing vectors of Minkowski space. So these are the Poincaré transformations. So within this language will be just something like this. So that will be that zeta mu is a translation. So some constant parameter a mu that parametrizes translations plus some matrix that parametrizes Lorentz transformations. You know, this omega, if you plug it back into this equation, has the property that omega mu omega with the two indices down is antisymmetric. And these are indeed the Lorentz transformations. Okay, notice that for Poincaré transformations, this vector field, which a priori, when you study this equation, could have been an arbitrary function of x, is at most linear in x. It has a term that is zeroth order in x, and there is a term that's linear order in x, and there is no higher order term in x. Okay? Now, the thing that I will not go through, but it's in the notes, and it's completely straightforward, and the way you do it is by differentiating this equation and using identities, really rather straightforward. The thing I will use is, okay, so for Lorentz transformations, I should say that what you can derive from this equation rather easily is that a Lorentz transformation has this property that d mu d nu of zeta rho equals zero. This is a direct consequence of this equation. And this is obviously is obeyed by this, right? Because that's what I just said, that zeta is at most linear in x. Now, conformal transformations give you more stuff, and are very similar to this derivation that you may have had before. What you find is that now the conformal Killing vector, that's the name of this equation, it's called conformal Killing vector. This equation implies that d mu, the third derivative, vanishes. Okay, so that means that the most general. So the first thing that we learn from this immediately is the following: is that the space of conformal transformations, infinitesimal conformal transformations, is finite dimensional because it can only be as large as the space of quadratic polynomials in the coordinates. And that's of course finite dimensional, right? Yeah. I can write the most general thing that has zero powers of x, the most general thing that has one power of x, and the most general thing that is quadratic in x. Well, that's finite dimensional, with one exception that we'll come back to. So now what you do is you write the most general polynomial of quadratic, which is quadratic, and now you plug it into the equation, and you see how many parameters you get, okay? Maybe before doing that, I want to note that there is an important exception to this story, which is in two space-time dimensions, where the set of conformal transformations is infinite dimensional. And this relies on the miracles that complex analysis, you know, showers us with. So if you take that equation and you plug in d equals 2 here, you put d equals 2 here, what that guy is, that the factor is 1. Now, something that it's convenient to do is to, maybe I'll do it in this small thing here. So in d equals 2, this equation will be just 1, right? For d equals 2. And now what you can do is use complex coordinates, introduce complex coordinates. So z equals x1 plus ix2, and z bar equals x1 minus ix2. Now, in these coordinates, the metric of Minkowski space is just, now I went to Euclidean space, but it's just d bar, right? That's just the standard Euclidean metric. So that means that the in components that the metric at the metric tensor in these coordinates is just proportional to is off diagonal of this type, right? It mixes the z and the z bar component. So now plug this equation for mu nu equals z or z bar, let's say. This equation tells you, so the right hand side is zero, right? Because the two components of the metric, if they are anti-holomorphic, vanishes. So you get this equation, d z bar zeta z bar equals zero. But what is the most general solution of this equation is the solution is any holomorphic function. So any function of the type, which is a function of just z and not z bar. And of course, the space of holomorphic functions is infinite dimensional. It's essentially any polynomial.
Why do you have that the right-hand side is zero?
Because now let's plug this equation for mu nu equals z bar. The right-hand side is essentially twice this, right? Oh, maybe you cannot see it, sorry, yes. But the metric, the only non-trivial component of the metric is the zz bar, not the z bar z bar. And the fact that in two dimensions you have an infinite number of solutions, that's why two-dimensional conformal field theories are super duper special. Okay, so now what did I want to do now? Oh yeah, I wanted to write the most general solution to the conformal Killing vector, which as I said is the most general polynomial, quadratic in the axis, that then satisfies the symmetries of the equation. So the most general infinitesimal conformal transformation is parametrized by the following vector field. So of course it will contain the things that we wrote for Lorentz transformations. So this will be, so we're gonna give names. So you know, when you have a transformation, we can associate a generator to the transformation, okay? That has the same number of indices as the parameter of the transformation. So for A mu, what is the generator associated to A mu? It's called P mu, called translations, so. For these guys, the generator is M mu nu, which are, as I said, Lorentz transformations. Now, the fact that the equation is cubic allows one extra term that is linear in the axis, which you already know about. This is the guy we were talking about during the first two lectures, which is a transformation that just locally rescales the coordinate. So this guy, we denote the letter D, that stands for dilatations. And now there is a slightly obnoxious looking transformation that is hard to have an intuition about, but we will see that it's not so bad once you take into account discrete transformations, which is, let me make sure I get the factors of two right. Yeah, so it's something that now is, so this was linear in X, now I can have something quadratic in X, which is B mu X squared minus 2X mu B dot X. And this guy, this transformation is parameterized again by a vector, right? So this was a scalar, right? It's just a parameter, so that's why the generator has no indices. Now this is generated by a vector that we will call K mu. And this transformation generated by B with all other parameters equal zero are called special conformal transformations. And they look nonlinear, so that's why it's harder to have an intuition. But we have an intuition about linear transformations. This is nonlinear, right? Maps X to X squared. Okay. Did I want to tell you about inversions or not? I guess I do. Yeah. Okay. Now we can count how many how many independent transformations we have in So this discussion, of course, is for D bigger than 2. I already said that for D equals 2, there's an infinite number of transformations, and Gang will tell you a lot about that case. So let's count in how many transformations we have in D space-time dimension. So how many transformations do I get from A mu? Sorry? D. Oh, well, yeah, we're in D dimension in general, so D, yeah. What about this one? Sorry? I cannot, I'm an old man, I cannot hear.
D minus 1.
Yes. Okay, what about the other one?
1.
1, and this one? D. Okay, so what is the, does anyone know how to add this? So this is, I'll probably make a mess. I'm skipping one step, but this can be, is this correct? So you have d square over 2, you have 2d minus a half d, is otherwise known as 3 halves d. So the guy that is linear in d is 3 halves d, and then you have a 1, which is what you get here. Okay. And the reason I'm writing it this way is because it turns out that these transformations can be grouped. Okay, so these transformations can be collected into, so first of all, one thing that I think you're familiar with, but maybe I should say, sometimes the things that are not said explicitly are the most opaque ones, is that usually transformations that you can, you know, do simultaneously generate a group, okay? Because you make a transformation, okay, and the transformation is invertible, you can go to the inverse transformation. If you do a transformation, I can follow it by another one, and that's essentially the definition of a group, okay? And so this set of transformations will generate a group, which will have, a group which will have as many parameters as those, essentially. And we will discuss them, we'll discuss what this group is in a second. Okay. These transformations, so these are transformations from a group. Because I can do all the things that the elements of a group have. It has all the axioms of a group. But now we're looking at a special type of transformation which is close to the identity. And it means that when you have a transformation and that forms a group, you can associate to the group when you do transformations for transformations close to the identity, you can associate a Lie algebra. Is this something that you're roughly familiar with or not? Yeah? Okay. And the way you prove that is very simple. You parameterize, essentially, one way to think about it is that take a group element, abstract group element, G, which is a function of certain parameters of the group, say that many parameters, G of alpha. I'm not going to write how many alphas there are. Alpha is a vector. And now I multiply it with a different group element, alpha bar. By the definition of a group, this guy is another group element, which is labeled by some function of alpha and alpha bar. Okay? And now what you do is you look at the transformations that are close to the identity. So you say something like G alpha is 1, plus I alpha A dA plus 1 half alpha A alpha B dAB, nara, nara, nara. So you use this. Second, you use the fact that if alpha bar is 0, which corresponds to the identity transformation, you know what F is for a small alpha bar. You know that F alpha 0 is what? To leading order. Sorry? Alpha, very good. And likewise, the other way around. That just means that because if I put an alpha bar 0, I'm not doing anything. So I better get back the same thing that I had it here, right? So now by expanding this to quadratic order, what you're going to find is that these t's that I introduced here obey this equation, which is essentially the definition of a Lie algebra. And this FAB satisfies the Jacobi identity, essentially. So for any group of transformations, if you look close to the identity, continuous group of transformations. OK, that's very important. It's a continuous group of transformations. Because I have these parameters, alphas are continuous parameters, right? If it was a discrete transformation, there is no continuous parameter to expand in. Those transformations close to the identity will generate a Lie algebra. And the Lie algebra, in a sense, contains all the information about the transformations which are close to the identity, which are the ones that we're discussing. These kind of transformations, small ones. You know, but with the small transformations, it's like when you go hiking, you know, you do one step, but you can get very far if you do many steps. So it's the same thing with transformations. You do a little Lie algebra transformation, but you can exponentiate it and you get very far. That's a lesson in life. Okay, so now we can do the exercise of determining what is the Lie algebra generated by conformal transformations. And this is something that I'm not going to do explicitly on the board. I'm going to tell you how you can do it in principle and in practice. It's very easy. It's not hard at all, but I don't think there's a point in me doing it. As I said, okay, so what's the way to think about it? The way to think about it is the following, is that so we have a vector field, okay? And geometrically, vector fields, again, these are a set of transformations, so vector fields also generate a Lie algebra, okay? So that means that if I take two vector fields, zeta 1, zeta 2, remember that these vector fields were something like zeta 1, mu, d mu, and this is zeta 2, mu, d mu, okay? And I look at this Lie bracket, which is just that commutator, essentially. You should think of this guy acting on an arbitrary function here. This, by definition, forms a Lie algebra, which is another killing, it will give you another vector, zeta 3, okay? So now what you can do is you can associate to each parameter or transformation a vector field. So we'll associate the vector field p mu, associated to p mu, the vector field a mu d mu, right? Is that clear? So this is one vector field associated to with these generators. Now we're going to, we'll associate a vector field also to m mu nu, which is going to be, the indices might be a bit of a mess, but okay, let me see. So omega let me write something and then I'll try to fix it. Let me see. So, no, sorry. Let me write it like this. So, no, I was doing it right. So it's x nu d mu. So the parameter is omega mu nu. That parametrizes the direction of the transformation, and that's the associated generator. And you do the same for all of them. I'm not going to write that. So for just one last one. So for delta, you would just call this lambda x mu d mu, okay? And for psi k mu, well, essentially you just write this times partial mu, okay? And now to construct the algebra is that you just compute this commutator. This sometimes is called the Lie bracket between vector fields. Do you think you know? Okay, so do you think you do you know what I'm talking about or? Okay, so now all that you do is that you take all these number of generators and you start commuting one with the other, okay? And I'm gonna write the commutation relations. So of course, one, some of them you know extremely well. So let me write with the Lorentz transformations. Mu rho m nu sigma plus three other terms that are completely fixed by the fact that m nu is antisymmetric. So there are three other terms that are just completely fixed by symmetry. All I have to do is now, and, oh, this is a mess. This is a mess. So this is m mu rho. All I have to do is antisymmetrize this quantity with respect to mu nu and rho sigma. So you get three extra terms. And then you have that m mu nu p rho is I eta mu rho p nu plus an extra term that you get by antisymmetrizing nu, mu and nu. Now, translations commute, famously, and that's easy because, you know, if you take the vector field of the commutator of two guys, since mu is a constant, you get zero, okay? Now, something that should be very obvious just from the way indices have to match in life, that's a rule number minus one. So, I mean, can someone tell me what would be the commutator of the Lorentz transformation, the Lorentz generator with K mu, with K rho? It has an index, right? So that means that it transforms as a vector. It's a vector of the Lorentz group. So it should transform at the same way as P does. From the point of view of the Lorentz group, P and K are just Lorentz vectors. So this has to be a vector. Being a vector is just a statement that the right-hand side has this property. That's the Lorentz, is the Lorentz representation in the vector representation. So that would be mu rho K mu plus another term. Now, a very important one, you want to know. So the hero of conformal field theory, one of the heroes of conformal field theory is this guy, the dilatation operator. The dilatation operator plays the role in conformal field theory to what the Hamiltonian plays the role in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The guy that we want to diagonalize in a conformal field theory is D. Because D is the eigenvalues of D tell us the critical exponents of the theory. So we want to understand how the algebra of D. So D with P mu is minus I P mu. And D with K mu is I K mu. Now, so here I want to make a comment. So that means that, so if D measures the eigenvalue, so if you want to measure the eigenvalues of D, P mu, I mean, does this part, does it remind you of something? Something that you've seen before? You have two operators, one acts on them with a minus sign, and the other one acts on them with a plus sign. This is like the harmonic oscillator. You have the Hamiltonian, and you have A and A dagger, and A raises the energy, and A dagger lowers the energy, and A dagger increases the energy. So this will be the similar here. P mu in the right convention will be the raising operator. So if you have an operator and you act with P mu, it will increase the dimension by one. That also fits your intuition, right? That P mu is a derivative. The derivatives have dimension one. But an operator that is active with K mu will have lower energy. Okay. Lower dimension. And by energy, mean dimension. And then the final one that I want to tell you about is that P mu K nu equals minus 2i. And now, what can you write here? I mean, again, this is only fixed by common sense and dimensional analysis and stuff like that. So what can I write on the right-hand side? The coefficients, of course, you cannot get from just doing this, but what kind of structure can I write on the right-hand side that would make sense? And the cast of characters are, you know, these generators and the metric. So obviously the right-hand side has to have two indices, right? That's the rule number minus one. So what can I construct with two indices? And that's linear. It has to, it's a Lie algebra. Lie algebras are linear. You know, the guy here is at most is linear. There's no t to the 17. Okay. Okay, proposals. M nu, yeah? Let me show you where I put the right coefficient. Yeah, so I can write M nu. Anything else? And eta times d, yeah. So I can write also eta mu nu that soaks the Lorentz thingies, and then I can put a scalar. Yeah, another thing I didn't say, but it should be obvious, is that d commutes with m mu nu because it has no indices, it's a Lorentz scalar, and the scalars commute with the Lorentz transformations by definition. So for example, for you it should be, it's a 30-second exercise, for example, to take this Killing vector maybe, and this Killing vector and prove that the commutator of D and P is P. And that's very easy because essentially I have to commute this guy with this guy, right? Now, the only interesting action that will happen is when this guy hits this guy, right? Because when it hits here, it will be canceled by the minus term. But what am I going to get if I do that? I just get A mu lambda D mu. Well, that's just another translation, okay? And by doing all of that, you will get this. Okay.
Could you explain why the second and the third are?
Sorry?
Could you explain why the second and the third are what you expect is?
Yes, I can try. So we have the Lorentz group, okay? The Lorentz group has a certain representations that it has, right? It has the trivial representation, like D is a trivial representation. It has no indices, right? It means that it commutes. Okay, so maybe it means that. Now, I assume that I don't have to explain, that you know from previous courses that P are you familiar, are you familiar with this commutator? That P does not commute with Lorentz transformations? I mean, intuition is, I think it's simple. So you have a vector now. If you apply a Lorentz transformation, it doesn't come back to itself, right?
It doesn't what?
Doesn't come back to itself. So it transforms. That's the mean, that, and the way it transforms is dictated by the fact that this object is a vector. So I'm using the word vector as opposed to a tensor. You know, you could define objects with more indices and they transform differently than vectors, right? If I ask how does a tensor transform under Lorentz transformation, it will transform differently than a vector. So from the point of view of the Lorentz group, P nu and K, so P and K are just Lorentz vectors. So with respect to just the Lorentz subalgebra, they're the same. Now, of course, with respect to everyone else, no. For example, one has charge one and the other one has charge minus one with respect to dilatation. But with respect to the Lorentz group, they're just Lorentz vectors. Okay, so now with some insight, inspiration, you can now write this that looks like a mess into something that maybe you can recognize. If you define, so now what I'm going to do is introduce extra indices. So we call mu the d-dimensional spacetime indices, right? So I'm going to introduce a bigger set of indices that includes mu that goes from 0 to d minus 1, right? I'm going to add d and d plus 1. So I made my matrix bigger by two entries, okay? And now I do the following definition. I defined an antisymmetric matrix element with the following entries. When the indices are mu nu, I'm going to call this guy M mu nu, the Lorentz generator, OK? When this guy is component D, D plus 1, I'm going to call this guy, yeah, this D is not the same as this D, but I don't know what to do about it. One is the space-time domain, one is the dimension of space-time. This one is the dilatation generator. So maybe I'll put a hat to mean operators. Then L mu d is 1 half p mu plus k mu. And L mu d plus 1 is 1 half P mu minus K mu. Now the claim is that with this definition, okay, and with this explicit form of the commutation relations, the else obey an Ali algebra that you've seen before, or a close cousin of something you've seen before. So now you're using this definition. I just compute the commutator of Lmn with MPQ, LPQ, and what you find is eta M P L and Q plus the three antisymmetrizations, where eta Mn is the metric in this higher dimensional space, which will be for the first d entries just the standard Lorentz metric. So minus, plus, plus. So this is the Lorentz metric, Lorentz signature. And then the entry that's associated to D is plus, and the metric associated to D plus one is minus. Okay. And this is a consequence of this and this inspired definition, identification of the L's with the conformal generators. But now, what is this algebra? This is very similar to the Lorentz algebra, right? That we wrote before. So that means that this Lie algebra, but now it's the Lie algebra that has more, it's bigger, because it has two more indices. So it means that you get the Lorentz algebra in two dimensions more, but also with a signature that has two negative eigenvalues, okay? And this Lie algebra is called SO 2, D. This is to compare with Lorentz in, say, in D dimensions, which is SO 1, D minus 1. Okay? And notice that the dimension of SO 2, D is this a D plus two dimensional antisymmetric matrix. How many components does that have? Well, it's precisely this number. It's D plus two plus D plus one divided by two. Okay. So this is a statement that makes manifest the fact that the conformal algebra in D dimensions is the Lorentz algebra SO 2, D, which you are kind of familiar with. Okay. As usual, I'm behind, but what can I do? So now, just quickly, I want to tell you about a very important. So this is everything that can be said about transformations that are close to the identity. But just like Lorentz group has transformations that are not connected to the identity, now we're going to discuss a particularly interesting conformal transformation that is not close to the identity. Okay. So we're going to talk about the following discrete transformations, discrete conformal transformations. And again, discrete means that they do not come in continuous families, okay? Just like parity in Lorentz transformations. So let's define an inversion as a transformation that maps x mu to x mu divided by x squared, okay? Now, what I want you to, well, so what does this transformation do first geometrically to convince yourself that this guy is not connected to the identity? What this transformation does is take the inside of the unit ball. It exchanges the inside and outside of the unit ball. Okay, so clearly this cannot be close to the identity because, well, if you're very close to the origin, you're sent very far away, right? So this is not close to the identity. So that's one statement. So that's why it's not close to the identity.
Here, all the light cone is sent to infinity.
Yeah. So one has to be careful. So in order to define this properly, you have to do what's called a conformal compactification of your space. So for Euclidean space, you're familiar, with the Riemann sphere, for example. So you have the plane, and you add a point at infinity so that transformations are properly. That's the Riemann sphere, for example. For Minkowski space, you can also conformally compactify Minkowski space. I may say something about that later, but yeah, you have to add a certain point at infinity so that the image of zero makes sense, or of the light cones makes sense.
But all of them are sent to the same point?
What does all mean?
If we define one point to be infinity, all the light cone is sent to the
same point. There is twister space, so it's a light ray is mapped to a point in twister space. Now, I think this will take us too far afield to discuss right now, but this can be absolutely precise, but I will not have discussion this and focus on, but we can discuss it later if you want, no problem. Or I may discuss it also later in the lectures. So the first point is that this is a transformation that is a Z2 transformation. Z2 means that if I act on it twice, I get back to myself. So this is very different than a continuous transformation, right? One thing that's also very important is that it changes the orientation of space-time. Do you know another transformation that changes the orientation of space-time?
Reflections.
Yeah, or reflections or parity, yeah. This is something I encourage you to check. And one point that I want to make is that the reason this guy is very important is that all this complicated story about the Lorentz algebra can be summarized in a quick way by saying that the conformal transformations, these ones I'm talking about, the infinitesimal ones, can be obtained by combining Poincaré plus inversions. So even if you didn't know about conformal Killing vectors or anything, if you had dreamt about inversions, you would have discovered this. And the reason you would discover it is the following. So I'll just write this quickly. So is that if you make the following sequence of transformations, you do an inversion, so that you map x mu to x mu by this thing, and then you do a translation, and then you do another inversion, you can show that this has the same effect as doing this transformation. Okay? You can also see it at the level of the Killing vectors. M nu is left invariant. Well, these two guys are exchanged, essentially. And this guy has a minus sign. Okay. So you see that starting with these two guys, we generated everything. Because by acting with I on P, we get K. We discover K. That's great. But now we didn't discover D. So how am I going to discover D? Well, now look at the composite transformation of P with K. That's going to give you D, right? So by following your nose with Poincaré and inversion, you get the whole conformal transformations. So I better stop here. There are more things to say as usual, but continue tomorrow.